Okay.
Yeah, that's the intro. So that's why you're getting everybody.
So this is going to be the fourth lecture of the cycle. I just observed that there are more people at the fourth lecture than the third lecture. So maybe, well, okay, we'll see. So today I'm going to talk about some additional structures, which I call Euler structures. Euler structures. So these structures naturally appear in this theory of torsions. Namely, as I explained last time, there is certain indeterminacy in the definition of the torsion. And when you want to eliminate this indeterminacy, you arrive at this notion of Euler structure. Right, you'll see immediately why it's called Euler structure. So it is defined for on any C double complex. So let's start with a C double complex, X. It's a C double complex. With zero Euler characteristic. All right. X has a C double structure that has certain amount of cells. So let A run over cells. So A. This is a set of cells of X. I forgot to say that it should be finite and connected. So the complex is finite and connected. Now, in each cell, let's choose a point, one point underline or under bar of A. So this is a point inside the cell A. So inside each cell, let's choose a point. Now, introduce the notion of Euler chain is a one chain. Such that its boundary is the sum over all cells of these points A under bar with sign minus one dimension of A. So that's the definition of Euler chain. So what does it mean? It means that you have what is a one chain? A one chain is a one-dimensional graph, roughly speaking, oriented. It's an oriented one-dimensional graph. Well, formally speaking, it's a formal linear combination, so it's a formal sum of certain arcs or with signs. So that's a formal linear combination of arcs. So all alphas are arcs in X. Now, the boundary of an arc is, of course, its endpoint. So if this is an arc alpha with a beginning point A and the endpoint B, then the boundary of alpha is B minus A. That's the definition. And the definition of the boundary of psi is the sum of the boundaries. So this is plus minus boundary of alpha 1. And so on, plus minus boundary of alpha m. So that's a formal linear combination of points with signs, plus or minus. And the condition is that the boundary is fixed. The boundary looks like that. Inside each cell, the boundary So the boundary hits each cell in one point with a sign determined by the dimension of this cell. All right, let me give you an example. So let X be the circle. Well, we choose a cell, cellular decomposition, which consists of one zero cell and one, so E0, or better, A0 is a zero cell, and A1 is the only one cell. Now, A0 bar, under bar, is, of course, the only point here. And A1 under by some point inside this cell. So the Euler chain by definition should be one chain whose boundary is which looks like this. Well, this is, for instance, an Euler chain. This is an arc psi, and the boundary of psi is A0 minus under bar. Minus A1 on the bar. So this is an Euler chain on the circle. All right. Now, why they are interested in these Euler chains? First of all, do they exist? Well, they exist because the Euler characteristic is supposed to be zero. So this is a zero chain. The sum is a formal zero chain, which bounds something, just because the total sum of signs is zero. So there is always an Euler chain. So this assumption that the Euler characteristic is zero implies that Euler chain exists. Euler chains exist. Now, of course, there are many Euler chains, and here we need to introduce some notion of equivalence, like in the definition of homology. So when two Euler chains are equivalent. So assume that we have two Euler chains, zeta and with boundaries above. And another Euler chain eta, whose boundary is a similar sum, also A under 1. Now we can take the difference. Now the difference is going to be a cycle. That's one chain whose boundary is 0. Therefore, it has a certain homology class. So that's this is one cycle. It has a homology class in one dimensional homology of X. Now, we say that zeta and eta are equivalent if this class is zero. So this is the definition of equivalence of Euler chains. Alright, now how many equivalence classes are called Euler structure. So Euler structure, this is of course an equivalence relation. This is clear. This is an equivalence relation on the set of Euler chains. But in each chain is equivalent to itself. This is reflexive and pensative. Okay, so Euler structure is by definition an equivalence class of Euler chains. So we have a certain set, so which I denote Euler X. This is a set of Euler structures. Now, if you want a neural chain, it's kind of half of a cycle. Half of a cycle. It's not a cycle, but it has determined boundary. So this is a set, sort of non-void set, as we know. Now we'd like to know how many elements are there in this set. Now, to describe this, I'm going to define an action of the one-dimensional homology group. So the group H1x acts on this set. As follows. If you take an element here, so if you take an element H in H1 of X, and you take an element E, an Euler structure, then what one should do? One should present X by cycle, present H by a cycle, one cycle. Let's say H tilde. Present E by an Euler chain. Euler chain Z. And now the action. The action is going to be now the action is defined by the formula H times E is the class, the equivalence class of the Euler chain. H tilde plus Z. So homology act on Euler chains, or rather cycles act to Euler chains, because if you take a cycle and you add a cycle to an Euler chain, you still have an Euler chain. This induces an action of homology onto the set of Euler structures. Well, this is indeed an action. Well, in this context, it is convenient to write multiplication here as an addition here multiplicative. So it is convenient to write this group in multiplicative form. So what you get is H A prime E is the same thing as H A prime E. So this is indeed an action. All right. Now, what can we say about this action? First of all, this action is transitive. This action of H1 x on order x is transitive. Why it is transitive? Because if you have two different Euler chains, the difference is a cycle. So you can add the cycle. So this action is transitive, and it is also free. And free. Which means that if HE is equal to E, this means that H is a trivial homology class. In multiplicative notation, it means it is one. Well, that follows from definitions. There is nothing in the literature. So, the conclusion is that there are as many elements here as elements in H1x. So, the corollary is that there are as many elements, as many Euler structures on x, as there are elements in H1 of x. Which the set may be infinite or finite. All right. Now, just two technical remarks. First of all, I chose these points inside the cells, and then somehow they disappeared from the notation. But the point is that the particular choice of points doesn't play any role. And why? Because there is a canonical way to change points. If, for instance, you take one cell, instead of one point, you take another point, you have one point, A, under bar, and now you want to take another one, then there is a canonical arc here inside the cell, which connects them. So subtracting or adding this arc, you may pass from an Euler chain with respect to this point to an Euler chain with respect to that point. So there is a canonical way to pass from one set of points to any other set of points. The key fact is that inside the cell, any two points can be related by an arc, which is unique after homotopy. Now, that was the first technical point. The second technical point what happens under subdivisions. We, in principle, are interested in some notions which are invariant under subdivisions.
Yes. One small question. When we speak of the cells at the CW complex, sometimes there's a little confusion, open cells or closed cells.
Here, the cells are open.
When I say,
right. Well, I needed to choose a point inside the cell, and of course I choose a point inside the cell.
The open cell.
So, cells are open. Now, what happens under subdivisions? Well, something similar happens. In a sense, all these notions are invariant under subdivisions. I'm going to explain this. So, if X prime is a subdivision, any subdivision of X, then, well, there is a canonical isomorphism over X and over of X prime. So these two sets are in canonical bijective correspondence. So how you can see that? The idea is roughly the same. Suppose you take a cell A, with its preferred point, A underlined, and now you want to subdivide it. So you have many more cells inside of various dimensions. So you want to subdivide this cell. Now you have many more points. Well, in this smaller CW decomposition, you have many more points here. Right? Inside all of the subcells, you need to choose. Maybe I take another column. So inside this subdivided cellular decomposition, you need to choose more points. Right? The vertices as well. That's it, right? With signs, right? With pluses and minuses. Now, how many points there are? If you count them with plus and minuses, it is just like the Euler characteristic. So it is the same as plus or minus one, depending on the dimension. So the sum of these points counted with signs is equal to minus one to the dimension of A. So inside this cell, therefore, you can choose a chain, just any chain, for instance, this chain. Well, all these segments should be oriented, and so on. They all should be oriented so that the boundary is the sum of these colored vertices. So there is a canonical chain here, say, let's denote it by zeta A. Zeta A, it's a one chain inside A. Such as the boundary of zeta A is minus one dimension A underline minus all these colored vertices. So let me call it, say, B minus one dimension B B underlined. So B runs over all the small cells inside L, inside A. B. So it, now if you have well, such a chain is not unique, but they are all homological in the ball. Because we are in the ball, doesn't matter which one we take. So now if we have a chain, an Euler chain with respect to this big decomposition, then we add such chains and the boundary changes. Instead of this term, we have this term. So that's roughly the idea. So in fact, when you subdivide, there is a canonical way to pass from Euler chains to Euler chains. Okay. And of course, this identification is H1x equivalent. The action of H1x is preserved here. So this equality is an H1x equivalent. All right. Now that was the definition of Euler chains and Euler structures. Now I'm going to give a completely different definition of Euler structures in completely different terms. And you will immediately see connection to the torsions. Now, to the end, I consider a maximal abelian covering. So let x tilde to x is a maximal abelian covering. I recall you that I defined the notion of fundamental family of cells. I define the notion of a fundamental family of cells in XT. Well, this is by definition a family of cells such that for each cell downstairs lies exactly one cell of this family. Okay. I will give example of them. So we take a cellular decomposition downstairs, it is lifted upstairs to the covering, and then over each cell downstairs we choose one cell upstairs. This is of course always possible, but the choice is not unique. Now a small observation says that each fundamental family of cells in X determines an Euler structure. So that's one possible way to think about Euler structures. If you have a fundamental family of cells upstairs, this gives you an Euler structure downstairs. Now, how you observe the hypothesis? Oh, this is a proof. The proof is very simple. And we will see it. So let say EI be a fundamental family of cells. Next. Now choose a point X next to you, and an arc alpha I from X to a certain point EI under which lies inside EI. So fix a point and choose an arc which connects this point to a point inside this on this cell.
We have X still disconnected.
Now all this is an extinct. Extinct is connected because X is connected. So this is possible. But I need some notation for this projection, so let it be P. Now let Xi be the sum of all i's, projections of this arc, P of alpha I, well, the sign, P of I, with sign equal to minus 1 of dimension dr. So what is P alpha I? Alpha I was an arc in X2. The P alpha I is an arc. So this is an arc in X. So this is a formal linear combination of arcs. That is one chain. So this is a one chain in X. And I claim that this is an Euler chain. This is an Euler chain. In fact, it is an Euler chain. Now we'll see it. Let's compute its boundary. The boundary is the sum of our i's minus 1 dimension pi. Now the boundary, well, so here I should write the boundary of pi of I. Now the boundary of an arc consists of two points. So this is P of I. It begins in P of X and it ends in some points P alpha I of 1, which is a point inside so alpha I letter point in EI. So this is the point inside P of EI. So by our assumption, this is the same as P of EI undermined. So the boundary is the sum of all i's minus 1 dimension EI P of EI undermined. So P of X should also appear with a certain coefficient plus sum of I minus 1 in EI P of X.
Minus.
But this doesn't matter because this sum is actually the Euler characteristic, which is equal to 0. So P of X doesn't appear. What remains is only this sum. So sum of I minus 1 dimension in I P of E I underline. Well, and this is the boundary exactly as we wanted. Inside each cell, there is one point which appears with this sign. So this is an Euler chain. Now, then you have to check that it doesn't depend on the choices. It doesn't depend on the choice of the point X. It doesn't depend on the choice of this arc. Now, why it doesn't depend on the choice of the arc? That is an a small and interesting point. What happens if we take another arc? Now, if so, this happens upstairs X, this is this arc alpha I. Suppose we take another arc with the same end points. Now, what is going to happen downstairs? In this psi, instead of projection P alpha I, we'll have this arc, P alpha I prime. Now, what is this? What can we say about this cycle? So the difference is the cycle. Well, this is not an upstairs cycle. This is a cycle which lifts upstairs, to a cycle upstairs. So the key point is that the induced homomorphisms in one homology is zero. So we have this induced homomorphism, and it is equal to zero. Because of the definition of the maximal abelian cover. So any cycle upstairs projects to a zero cycle downstairs. So this is a zero cycle. These two arcs are homological. Therefore, the order of chain is well defined. Okay, so this is a well-defined construction which allows you to pass from a fundamental family of cells to order of structure. And you, of course, you can reverse this construction. You can, if you have an Euler chain, you can present it in this way. All right. Now, this already explains why Euler structures are allowed to get rid of the definition of the indeterminacy in the definition of a torsion. Now, how we should proceed? Suppose you have, well, as usual, we have this fine CW complex. As we said, we have a field, we have a homomorphism phi from H1, from the group ring of the homology group to F, and assume now that you have an Euler structure. And as I explained last time, we need also a homology orientation, like omega be a homology orientation. Now we can define a refined torsion tau phi x omega e. Well, which is a well-defined element of F. Now, how we proceed? Well, you proceed in the following way. You consider this complex C phi x, which is this tensor product of F over the group ring H1x over with the chain complex of X tilde. So this is a cellular chain complex of the maximal abelian covering. The action here is determined on F is determined by phi. You have this complex. You choose a fundamental family of cells which determines your Euler structure. And then you compute the torsion, as I explained, if the complex is acyclic. So the definition is tau phi xp omega is just the torsion of this complex with respect to this basis determined by such a fundamental family of cells. If it is acyclic, so this is a non-zero element of the field, so f star. If the complex c phi x is acyclic, and you say it is equal to zero in F if it is not acyclic. So the role of omega I explained last time. It appears here to make the torsion have a definite sign. So here it is understood they are proceed with respect to a basis in this chain complex determined by fundamental family of cells corresponding to this Euler structure. Now, of course, this zero is not very informative, but sort of it allows us not to think about a cyclic, non-acyclic case. If it is a cyclic, it is a torsion. If it is not a cyclic, it is zero. It's a convenient way to convenient language. All right. Now, it is very easy to see how this torsion depends on the oil structure. If we take another oil structure, so another oil structure is obtained by an action of an element of H1 of X. So if you take a torsion which corresponds to HE, so with the same molecular orientation but a different oil structure, what happened with the torsion? It just multiplied by phi of H. So in fact, in the usual theory, there is no oil structures. It is because of this formula that the torsion has such an indeterminacy, certain multiplicative indeterminacy. And when we have oil structures, then the torsion is uniquely defined. Now, how to see this formula? That's very easy to see. Just you take a fundamental family of cells, which represents E, and then you apply that transformation to one of the cells, just to one. Then you translate it by H. This means that the oil structure is multiplied by H, and the torsion is multiplied by phi of H. Well, that's very easy to see when one analyzes conditions. Now I want to speak about something different, namely about oil structures on smooth manifolds. Now, why we need to discuss it? Well, of course, I gave this nice combinatorial definition of oil structure, but so how to see them in practice, right? Suppose you have a manifold, a sphere, torus, how to see an oil structure? Now, there is a completely different definition, which I'm going to give now. Now, I start with a manifold, say, M. So let M be closed, smooth, well, M-dimensional manifold. Well, with zero oil characteristics. Well, actually, if the dimension of such a manifold is odd, then the oil characteristic is zero automatically. So that's not a big restriction. Especially since we are interested in three-dimensional. All right. Now I define the set of vector M. Set whose elements are non-singular vector fields, non-singular vector fields on M. Well, modulus of an equivalence relation. So elements of this set are represented by non-singular vector fields. Such fields exist because of this condition. Non-singular means no way zero. Well, vector field should be at least continuous, but maybe smooth. Now, what is this equivalence relation? Equivalence relation is as follows. If you have two vector fields, U and V, then so these are two non-singular vector fields on M. Yeah, I mean, when I say vector field, I mean tangent vector. So we say that U and V are equivalent if the restriction of on m minus point are homotopic. V restricted on m minus point. So that such a moving of a point is called puncturing. So when you puncture the manifold and you restrict your vector fields on the complement of a point, they should be homotopic in the class of non-singular vector fields on this complement. So this is this equivalence relation. It is indeed an equivalence. Now, what is good? What is connection between this definition and the definition of Euler structures? Well, every such manifold has a C1 smooth triangulation. So every such manifold has smooth triangulations. And you can consider the Euler structures in this combinatorial sense on such triangulations. Now, the connection is the following. This is a theorem. That the vector M is canonically bijected isomorphic to Euler M. This is, in fact, the same object. Now, here on the right, of course, I mean that we need to choose a smooth triangulation, consider all Euler structures in these triangulations. Then there is a bijective correspondence, which behaves well with respect to subdivisions and so on. Well, you can imagine what I mean. What is important is that, in fact, these are the same objects. So, in particular, it means that when you have a non-singular vector field, then you can plug it into the definition of the torsion, and you get some invariant torsion invariance. And so, in principle, you get invariance of vector fields, which allows you to distinguish different vector fields, up to homotopy, up to diffeomorphism, because torsions are diffeomorphism invariants. All right. Now, today, I want to specialize even further to the case of three-dimensional manifolds. So the case I'm interested in is M equal to 3. Now in this case, I would like to introduce one more additional structure, which is called spin C structure. Spin C structures on string manifolds. Now, what is spin C? First, I recall what is spin C group. Well, you, of course, know the S or N group, which has a canonical extension, spin N. This is a Z2 extension. For any N, let's say, starting from now, spin C N is by definition the following thing. You take spin N, you multiply by the circle, and you factorize by Z2. Where Z2 is embedded here in the diagonal way. So Z2 lies here by this inclusion, and Z2 lies here in the obvious way. So that's the definition of PNC. And now, in the case which we want to consider, this group is just much more familiar with you. This is just you. Well, maybe I say that in the general case, you can project. In the general case, when you kill S1, when you kill this factor, what you get is spin n over Z2, that's SON. So you have such an extension. And the kernel is S1. This is in the general case. Well, in this case, this is very well known that U2 factorized by its diagonal subgroup U1 gives SOC. So this is a very special case. This is a special case. Now, what is a spin C structure in the manifold? If you have a n-dimensional manifold, one factor in area. If you have an n-dimensional manifold, then it has a tangent bundle. Well, if you suppose that a manifold is oriented, so M is oriented, then the structure group of this bundle is, of course, SOM. This is the structure group. Now, if you have a lift of this structure group to spin CN, then such a lift is called a spin CN structure. Spin CN structure on M is a lift of the structure group SOM in the tangent bundle. This is a tension bundle to spin CN. So, of course, that's not a quite formal definition. The formal definition says that you should have a principal spin CN bundle over M such that the associated such that quotient in by S1 you obtain the frame bundle, the frame SON bundle of M. Okay. Now, we shall be interested only in three-dimensional case. So what happens in the three-dimensional case? Well, there are two facts to know. First, every foreign entity, closed three-dimensional case, as a spin C structure. So that's the first thing to know. And this fact is trivial because the tangent bundle of such a manifold is trivial. All three-dimensional, all closed-oriented three-dimensional manifolds are parallelizable. So the tangent bundle is trivial, and of course, the structure groups, a group reduces it to the trivial group, not speaking about big group. Now, how many spin C structures are there? Now, that's a general fact, but I want to speak only about three-dimensional case. So the group H2 of M acts freely and transitively on the set have spinsy structures. But let me denote this set somehow. On this set, spin Cm of spinsy structures on M. Well, this is a special case of a known fact, which holds actually for any in any dimension, and which comes from the fact that there is the difference between S O N and spin C N is just a circle, and. And circle bundles over manifold are classified by elements of H to M. So I don't want to go into details because of the following result. So the following is true. So that is the theorem. There is a canonical bijection between the set of spin C structures on the three manifold. So M is a closed oriented three manifold. Mm-hmm. And the set of the set vector. So in fact, there is nothing new. It's all this different forms of one and the same object. So all spin C structures on M, the set of spin C structures bijectively correspond to the set of vector non-singular vector fields up to this equivalence relation. Which itself, as we know, is the same as the set of Orlov structures on triangulation. So why it's an interesting? Because you have a species structure, which is certain lift of certain structure group, and then eventually you can represent it just by a family of cells in certain triangulation in certain coloring. So this gives combinatorial representation of species structures. All right, now I'm going to explain why this is true. Oof. Well, that's very easy. Suppose you have a vector field. Let V be a non-singular vector field. Non-singular vector field on M. Then the tension bundle splits as a sum of one-dimensional bundle, which consists of vectors proportional to V, and the orthogonal bundle. So this is R, V, perpendicular. So this is one-dimensional vector bundle consisting of vectors proportional to V. This is an orthogonal complement with respect to some remaining metric. Now, what is the structure group here? The structure group here is trivial because, it's one-dimensional oriented bundle. The structure group is trivial. Now, this is a two-dimensional oriented bundle. Why it is oriented? Because M is oriented. M is oriented. This is oriented. So this bundle is also oriented. So this is a two-dimensional real oriented bundle, therefore its structure group is S1. So each such vector field allows, gives you immediately a reduction of the structure group here to S1. And S1, as we know, lies in spin C3. So this is a subgroup of U2, which is the same as spin C3. So each vector field gives you a reduction of the structure group to U2. So that's an error in one direction. From a vector field, you constructed a spin C structure. Well, then it shows that it is well defined and bijective. Okay? Maybe I have 2 minutes to say a few words about this theorem, which holds in any dimension, which I didn't explain. Just I say 2 words about the proof. which is the idea of the proof is very easy, but so I skip the technical details. So the proof. So you take a C1 triangulation. So let X a C1 triangulation of M. Then you want to, basically you want to move from this direction, from Euler structures to vector fields. You want to construct vector fields. How do you do that? On a C1 triangulation, there is a canonical vector field. Well, I'm trying to draw it. So there is a canonical vector field on X, which is due to Whitney. Well, it's the simplest vector field you can imagine. These are the Bayes centers of the symplices. The field goes like this. Here it goes like that. It is tangent. Here it goes like that. Now and here it goes like this. Well, this vector field is nice, except that, you can proceed in all dimensions. Now, this vector field is nice, except that it has singularities. Then the singularities lie in the very centers of symplices. So these are singular points of this vector field. So there is a canonical vector field, but it has singularities. Now, assume that you have an Euler structure. You can represent it by a chain, which looks like that. You have a point and arc connected this point to a very center, and another arc connected to the same point to all four centers. So it's a kind of spider with many legs, as many legs as there are very centers of symplices, as many legs as symplices. So let me draw the spider here. This is an embedded graph, this is the manifold. And you have a vector field, this canonical vector field, whose singular points are just the end points of this graph. Of course, this theorem is for manifolds of dimension at least 3, so we can assume that this graph is embedded. It has no self-intersection. Now you take a small ball, a neighborhood of this spider, like this, inside your manifold. Now this Whitney vector field is non-singular outside of this ball. Outside of this ball, it is non-singular. And it does not matter what happens inside the ball. Why? Because since the Euler characteristic of M is zero, this non-singular vector field outside of the ball extends to a non-singular vector field inside the ball. There is no obstruction. So if you have a manifold and a non-singular vector field outside of a small ball in this manifold, then it extends inside this ball. But the only obstruction to this extension is the Euler characteristic. Since it is zero, this Whitney vector field extends inside. Of course, in a different way, right? This extension is not unique, but up to our occurrence relation, it is all the same. It is still the same element. So this defines the map from Euler structures to vector fields. And then you show it is budget and well defined. So that was the idea. Now I explain today this additional structures, Euler structures. I explain that they are the same as vector fields on manifolds. In the case of manifolds, it is just the same as vector fields. And in dimension 3, it is just the same as spin C structures. Also, I explain that when you have such an additional structure, you can you get a refined torsion, which is well defined and depends on the structure. Okay, so next time I will speak more about three manifolds and species structures on three manifolds and the invariants, and I will finally mention connection with Ibach-Witten invariants. All right, that's for the next time. Thank you.
Theorem there, you don't need that the Euler characteristic is zero, right?
For this theorem?
Yeah.
It's in dimension 3, and the 3 dimensional manifold, they always have Euler characteristic zero.
Okay.
With closed 3 manifold. If they have boundaries, then you need to be more specific anyway. You need to change. You should say what happens with the boundary.
I thought maybe, as far as history, some of these ideas are doing a help. So, like, you wrote a paper in 1927, and you used the index method, which is what this is, showing that the Euler characteristic is zero if and only if there's I singular
vector. That's a Hopf's theorem, which says that Euler characteristic is the Euler abstraction for vector field.
So, I think some of these ideas are being helped by those same ideas of the index. But I'm not sure who came.
What is interesting with this canonical vector field, and I think it appears in the work of Whitney when he started his what we know under the name of Stiepel-Whitney classes.
Yeah.
And he wanted to show that there are abstractions to existence of certain independent families of vector fields. That's where he introduced specific vector fields.
Yeah.
In fact, there is an explicit formula which.
This last argument you had, M could be, I mean, you have the Euler of M. M doesn't need to be a manifold, a smooth manifold. So it could be making it into a smooth manifold from Euler of M.
Yeah, but if M is not a manifold, what is a vector field? So
you define a vector field the way you just did, via the.
But then it depends on the choice. Yeah, I think you are right. You can.
Will it become a smooth manifold, or is there? See what I mean. You
don't really need that it is a manifold.
No.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
It just has to be a PL manifold.
It should be PL,
or
triangulated space. Then you can define vector fields.
Sure.
That's right. Okay.
Thanks, Weimer.
Thank you very much.